Fiona, let's get you
I'm borrowing Lisa's article because I left mine at home, which had all my little comments on it. And I have notes that I printed out, but because the sun came up this afternoon, I printed, typed out half of them, then printed out the page and hand wrote the rest outside. It's still on my patio.
Oh no, I hope it doesn't rain. Possibly
getting very damp. So I've got the first part that I did that kind of went up to about page 199, I think, somewhere around in there. So I'll kind of have to go through the rest of Lisa's from that. I found it a really interesting read. I don't know if anybody else. No?
This is the
Hitchcock and Hughes chapter 8 on the life history.
Yeah, I hope so. This book is a good book. I almost chose this as a course text, but the reason I didn't is because of that. I thought, how the hell am I going to help graduate level students understand, you know, a place when this text is all over the map? And so I got worried about that. But now that you're getting to, you know, more in that place, these chapters we're going to read, I hope are good.
Because that explains a lot. Because I thought that a lot of it was at level 2 or type 2, but then they kept going into to type 1 sort of aspects. We're thinking, well, that doesn't really apply. How does that apply? So kind of. So I highlighted on page 184 that it's a respect for individual accounts and subjectivity. That life history interview, that's what it's about. So that, to me, that kind of identified, I thought, where we were exactly. Which I went back and kind of checked in with respect to Flick, Chapter 2, when there were the various different levels that we had there as well. And that, because it was there was the level of the individual, the who, and then there was the discourse level of the interaction, and then there was the culture.
Yes.
And to me, this started very much in the who, when you're looking at the individual.
Yeah. And again, those map on too, don't they, to those three.
Yeah. So that's on page 185. Okay. Life history data being incorporated into research is another source and level of data. I thought that was interesting that on page 187 they talk about that this is now a tool, a method that can be incorporated. Because when I first started looking at this, to me it was a method all into itself. I wasn't quite thinking how it could be incorporated with others. And I had to kind of bend my brain around that and understand how you could. I guess it would depend on what kind of information you wanted to understand. I don't know. What does everybody else think on that one? Like using it as a method in a mixed method study? Beef, no comment?
I'm recovering my voice, but...
You don't have to come.
Repeat the question.
Just the idea of it being used. When I first encountered this, I didn't see how it could necessarily be something, a method that you could use in a mixed method study where you've got this style of interview plus you're using a variety of different other data collection. To me, it was a style and you're going in a certain direction, and I didn't see how you, but later they talk about how you can then use that to get information about a culture, or you can get contextual information out of it.
Well, that's easy. Back to Marty. I really liked your project, but
no, it's provided us with good connections.
If we go back to the notion of a quasi quantitative qualitative, where I use the quantitative first to determine the different categories, and then to explore each individual category, you use a biography of identifying an individual that represents that category, or a combination of many, and determine what their story says. That's why.
Yeah, I think it has a definite business application, actually.
Well, I think it's got a whole book. I think it'll be famous. Because I liked the example, was it in here, where he followed a principal of a school for, you know, months, and wrote a whole book about what he called the day in the life of a principal, right? Would be the day in the life of an entrepreneur where you actually just shadow one and you do your whole thesis on one person. write the book. And you'd probably find out more, much like it says here, analyzing the experience and attitudes of an individual. We always reach the point where we're really treating it as instances that are more about general classes of data and facts and information. So the more universal we actually become, the more we're understanding the individual. That would probably take some selling.
I'm more to just doing the research on the disadvantaged or talented children.
Sure.
Because I'm looking very much at the dynamic part of an entrepreneur's life, so it wouldn't be a day in the life of, it'd be the transition of the entrepreneur from...
Yeah. Over time.
Well, with the life history that
I have. Exactly. The life history is perfect for that. Yeah, it could well be.
Don't we all run straight for the biography section in the bookstore, the autobiography section?
Well, that's what I was just saying, you make a lot of money. Everybody would want to know about these famous entrepreneurs that you interviewed.
First, you've got to get access to them.
Yeah.
Be able to shadow them.
Yeah. Okay, the next thing I looked at was the notion that they talk about on page 188 of the empathy between the researcher and the participant. And that really tied back into, I thought, what we were talking about last day with the co-researcher and the relationship that you established with them. I thought that was really interesting. Also on page 188, develop a clear appreciation of the complex processes of life, or is it, of social life, identity, and change. I thought that was like a really interesting, sorry, not having my own notes.
Middle of the page.
Right. And I was trying to unpack that a little bit. Processes of social life, identity, and change. Identity and change, I have no problem with. It's the social life, and I guess it's how the person sees themselves in their culture. Is that anybody else have a thought on that one?
But why does it necessarily have to be? Of course, they would situate themselves not necessarily within that social life, but in opposition or in juxtaposition to. So it could be, this is what I recognize as being the society which I live in or reside within, but I don't necessarily see myself as being there. My identity and my change are separate from that.
I think it's three layers, I think, to it that you could, it doesn't necessarily have to even be all three, does it? Those are the three different layers I think you could look at. But again, that leaves us at that we're still at type two. Go ahead.
Wouldn't the social life then become a system? Sorry, going back to Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
But
good. And you could say that that's one of the things in it, a story, a narrative, a life story. Can be looked at those three levels. You could be looking at what happened in the person's life, okay, which to a large extent would be of interest to Marty, because he wants to know what happened, what dynamics really went on. But you'd also want to know what your entrepreneur's perspective on those things were. At the second level, what was his or her interpretation of those things, and so on. And you could even want to look at the third layer, which is looking at the bigger picture within the culture of business, within the climate of whatever capitalism.
Or even just within the third network of contacts. Like, what were they thinking at the time is type two.
Yeah.
And then why did they express what they did is to type three to get the results that they wanted is type one.
It could feed back and, I can see what you're saying, yeah.
That's kind of the enacted environment that if I see a goal that I'm after, I tell people that I'm after that goal.
Yeah.
And I'm passionate about that goal. And by telling them, I've then gotten into the why am I telling people, why am I discussing this? Not necessarily what am I discussing, just why am I bringing up this topic?
Mm-hmm.
Just type three. And then in doing that, people realize my alignment with that goal and facilitate my achieving that goal,
mm-hmm.
which then leads me to creating that event, which would be type one.
Okay, yeah. But we might get you to type three yet. You never know. You might, when you take it back into the political, background and thinking about the politics involved and what was going on, it might lead you out into that too.
Okay. The next thing I looked at is around page 189 and the three types of life history. So I was trying to fit in what the retrospective, contemporaneous, and naturalistic would be, and I was kind of looking at the retrospective is really easy to grasp for me. The individual's current interpretation of or feelings towards the past, so they're looking at their past through a current lens. The contemporaneous was the one I had to stop and think about, and I liked the fact that they said it's more likely to draw on use of materials. So I was thinking in my own research I was using this, I was having students look at videos that they edited, and tell me what they thought about and what they had been thinking. So there was a past, but the past was like 2 weeks earlier. So I was using it, and I thought that was more of an example of the contemporaneous. So I was getting them to describe what they had been doing. But mm-hmm. And the naturalistic, being the autobiography or first-person life history, which I'm trying to see how this would fit in. I mean, I understand what it is, a first-person account, but in research, I mean, aside from the using an autobiography to actually study, if you were looking in a school setting, I mean, how would it work? Would you have somebody write their history, or that's what I'm trying to...
An interview can produce a life history.
Okay, so it wouldn't necessarily be a retrospective one, it would be a naturalistic one?
And so is the difference between the two.
Because a life history interview is going to be one that's trying to elicit the person's story of their life, rather than trying to ask them specific questions about a given phenomenon. Like mm-hmm. saying, you know, what's your opinion of, you know, the gender differences in your school? It would be rather, you know, what is the, can you tell me the, you know, how you came to be at this school? What, you know, tell me your history, your life history, and any gender implications that might have come out of that life history story, if you like, would maybe be more your focus in that case.
Well, in which case, I don't see the difference between the retrospective and the naturalistic, necessarily. I mean, I guess what they're saying is that you could have a naturalistic one that is either retrospective or not. To me, it doesn't completely make sense then.
Oh, I see what you're saying. They're in the words. Okay, the first one's in the words of the individual.
Yeah.
Either in their book or in their talk, if it's through an interview.
The first one you mean retrospective. Okay.
No, that's naturalistic.
Naturalistic, mm-hmm. Okay. So it's actual published life story in the words of the individual.
Yeah.
So you're not editing it. You're not asking them to... necessarily answer any questions. They're just providing their life history without any particular focus being given to them by a research question, that kind
That's
of thing.
That's right.
The fact, maybe you might be looking at someone's...
If I went to look at it purely for gender afterwards and started looking at it, then I would be getting to that third type.
So then that could be type three then, is the naturalistic, where you're not actually... Okay. That makes sense. Whereas the other two would be at type two. Okay. Looking at it from that perspective, I get it.
Which
naturalistic would be type 3 because it's or not necessarily, I suppose, because if you're putting because you could have a because you could if the researcher's putting a forward and a conclusion sort of thing on it. Researcher sifts, distills, edits, and interprets the words. Although retaining the feel and authenticity. Okay, this is in presentation.
Yeah, I'm kind of.
I think they're mixing up
how to present the modes of presenting a life history. You can leave it in the actual words, right? You can organize it thematically, or you can mm-hmm. actually look in terms of putting in your own mm-hmm. interpretations
right.
and things.
Okay, that's the right. Okay, so that's the paragraph that's just below. But then I'm still, the paragraph at the very top, though, is talking about retrospective, contemporaneous, and naturalistic. Okay, that takes me back to still not understanding the distinction between the retrospective and naturalistic. Go. But I'm going to couch that and kind of look at it on my own then. Okay. page 193, interpretation, collaboration, and introspection seem to be the key ingredients of life history work. There's probably a paragraph that talks about... Sorry, this is so hard without my actual... Introspection, okay. I just was highlighting it that I'd pulled that kind of out, but those are the three things that seem to be key. And, okay, 193, I was looking at the, and we were talking in the break, some of us, that this seems like a very repetitive chapter, that they keep coming back at the same things in different ways. Mm-hmm. So one of the ones that's in various different chunks all over the place is the nature of the unstructured or semi-structured interview. Mm-hmm. And various different places they talk about it on 193 and then again on 197, but I did like the one point that they make about the nature of it being it's a misnomer, calling it unstructured,
yes,
because you can't really have an unstructured.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and the way they talked about that, I thought that was kind of interesting, that you can conduct the actual interview, allowing the interviewee to wander freely or give them a particular focus. And I thought that was kind of interesting, depending on what you were trying to get from them, that you could choose from those two different things. The other thing I really liked that they said was talking about applying and starting to do an analysis as you're there and as it's actually taking place, so that you're actually seeing what you're getting and what direction it's going, so you can make decisions. I thought that would be really hard, to be listening to what they're saying and analyzing it and directing it all at the same time. But possibly doable.
Yeah, it's more on an intuitive level that it happens. Like something will hit you. I remember with my interviewee with the OCD study, when she said something that just struck me as this idea that she was transferring it as like becoming like a religion, you know, the rituals and obsessions, and that was her religion. And I got her to talk about things related to that without using that word, because then when I came back and had a second interview, she made that revelation herself, purely by my pointing out the things she had said, putting them together. She said, "Do you think this is my religion, maybe? Like my religion?" She said. But it had struck me that it was like a religion before I even pulled that together and put it in front of her during the interview. Intuitive level entirely.
I've kind of heard about the difficulty of balancing all that in our research methodology course, and that's when you almost want to bring in a second interviewer, so that one just kind of records everything that's happening, and the other one can think on their toes and really guide the conversation without worrying about recording.
Okay. If you're not using a tape?
Yeah, that's not using a tape.
It's also used sometimes with focus groups.
Yes. That's right. Focus groups are very difficult with tape. Although it's easier now with multi-channels. You can clip little mics on different people and they all feed into a different channel, so you know who said what.
Well, if you keep it to less than eight.
You start to learn their voices.
That you do. You have it memorized. I still remember
the
voices.
You don't
get
it in your sleep, you know. Kind of.
Yeah.
It makes me think of when you're teaching and you have a plan in mind and you have a lesson plan and you're teaching, but you're hearing that this behavior is going on there, this behavior is going on there, and you're changing what you're teaching, and you're thinking that you're making all these decisions, it's feeding how you're teaching, and you've lost the original plan, it no longer exists, it was a starting point only, and it sounds like the same kind of thing.
A lot of people don't feel confident enough to do this during interviews because they worry that they only have this one shot, and they got to ask their questions that are on the page, and it's a shame, really, because I used to tell my students, I really don't believe there's any such thing as a bad interview. I think there are better interviews, but there's no such thing as a bad interview, and as long as your participant's talking and doing most of the talking and not you, then you've got an interview to work from. You will have something to work from and not to worry so much about it, and if that helps take a little pressure off so you can allow more things to come from it, it really is true.
I think for me what it really underscored was the nature of my misunderstanding originally of what grounded theory was, where I didn't understand you had to have the research question articulated. I sort of thought, well, you can just kind of go in and you'll have a vague idea of what you want, and you can kind of figure out the question as you go. And I was thinking, when this came up, I thought, yeah, that totally wouldn't work. You would have to have a really clearly articulated question, because otherwise you wouldn't have anything structuring the interview, and you wouldn't know if you were going on or off. So,
kind of reminds me of one of the examples your guest speaker had. He used the analogy of the children's birthday party. All you want to know is that you are having a good birthday party, and you can either plan everything out to the T, have milestones and time slots and reward systems in place, and I can't chart with exactly what's going to happen, but it's not really going to ever happen like that. So what you do is you just seed, you make sure you have certain topics that you can draw people to if you need to, so like the football, the cake, the barbecue. But you don't have them specifically slotted in certain areas, but you make sure that you have something that can transcript the conversation.
Oh, very good. It's a good analogy. Actually, that works when we come to thinking about interviewing next week, interview skills. I tend to divide my interview into just basically my focus of inquiry, and then just having probes and prompts, I call it. And that's it. And prompts are basically what you just described. Whereas probes are things like the Freudian or the silence, or the, that's really interesting, can you tell me more about that? Or the reflecting back. So what I hear you telling me, or what I believe you're saying so far, is da 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 da, and then just waiting for me. All those kind of things, those are probes, those get people to talk. My prompts are just the key things in my focus of inquiry. And then I avoid the idea of having any questions at all. Because as soon as you write down a question, you are going to ask it like that. Right? You're going to word it like that. But if you have those prompts, those areas, you're going to allow for more. Yeah, I like that very much. It's good. Who was the speaker?
Dave Snowden.
Snowden. I know that name.
Eventually, we're hoping to have the MP3 or the full video on.
Oh, where is he from?
He's an associate prof at Royal Roads in Italy and about three other universities.
Wow.
I think he's based on the East Coast.
Well, so he sounds really good, dynamic speaker. Good. Thank you for sharing.
Okay, now I'm off of my notes on the computer because they end. I think that our discussion earlier, like the validity, I'm not sure, because we covered it out of Flick, didn't we? The Flick chapter 6, it tended to come out and we had that. So I don't know if anybody feels we need to go back through that. It came up. And I think I was conflicted over it because of this whole, I was trying to figure out where the heck I was and I didn't understand it and I had question marks all over the place. But I think they've been answered for me. I don't know how everybody else feels.
Good. Yeah, I put it right here on page 198. I put, is that where you're looking at? I've got the whole page marked off, and I just put problematic search for validity here.
Yeah.
This is type one issues of validity to a large extent, and one that the ethnographic researcher would be more interested in.
And then I know I had comments on these, but
that's why I got sleepy.
Is that why I'm handwriting it? Thank you for letting me borrow this, by the way. I don't know that I, without actually having my notes, that I could be doing anything other than kind of looking at Lisa's comments and going, oh yeah, I have underlined that too. So is there anybody else that had anything towards the end of it? But
I like one quotation on page 205. Last paragraph before problems and possibilities. I think it's an interesting one to think about. It says, the message is clear. Change in teachers' work is a change in teachers' lives. Any attempts at reform, school improvement, or innovation which do not take account of this fact will inevitably fail. Biography and life history research has a clear function to play here. Like that, in terms of justifying the nature of why we need life history research. is that implementing anything, any strategy, focusing on any problem, isn't just about changing the way someone works, the way their pedagogy might be, or the way they're, but rather it's gonna impact on their life. Because we can't separate out the I as a teacher versus the I as a person. And that's going to have a whole new, it will impact on the perspective. And that, the reason I like that too, is because it typifies our narrative story. You have the nature of the change, the thing itself. You have the person's perspective on the change. And then at type three, you have this very idea that there will be an impact on the person as well as the person as teacher. And so you look at that social function, where that's coming from, what they're going to grab, what meaning message in societal message they're going to grab in creating or perhaps constructing or no, what I want to say is what's the potential new ideology? That would be a good way to think of it. That's going to emerge from the change, right? And we saw a great case of that in education when we went from an idea of collective education to meeting the needs of individuals. Okay. Completely different ideology got placed on it, and that in changing wasn't just a change in practice of teaching, but it was a change in how teachers even viewed themselves in relation to children.
Mm-hmm. This is a question. The I as a teacher and I as individual, another way of looking at that is, I just learned about this right before class, but the I and the me, and it's in regard to Mead in the 1930s, he was a contemporary of Dewey, and he argued that the I is the encultured or codified construct that we project, and the me remains the individual, which outside of, say, a professional perspective, just in regard to, say, family, the comfort level, that's who's projected. So is that what we're getting at in regard to the I of the teacher and the I of?
I was thinking about it more in terms of multiple identities, like being that we don't have a single core self, that we have identities that are shifting and fluid, but people have taken on board that. Hare does an even more up-to-date and intense analysis of I and me. And what his caution, or what my caution about it is that we have to be particularly careful when we start to analyze things based purely on people's use of I and me, because there are also a lot of conventions in talk, and verbal habits, and so on, that the pronouns and, you know, lack of, they're producing social action, okay? So in other words, Hare is pointing out to us, I and me serves a really big performative function in talk, okay, that may not necessarily be relating to the subjective experience of identity, I me, and the split that you're speaking about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and the perspective I learned about it.
Dewey's would be the two, type two here,
yeah.
Thinking there could be that separation. And he would say, no, it's serving a function quite often too. For example, think of it this way, when you ask somebody something and they don't really want to commit that it's their opinion, they'll say, well, you know, a lot of people believe that, you know, Bush is an idiot, rather than say, I believe Bush is an idiot. Now, we would see that as performative function, using I.
That's like the last,
or
the
I, we.
News from last week was like that, when the girl was referring to, I can't remember her wording, but she kept using other pronouns, not saying, I think this way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That would be a case where you would analyze. You could analyze that very clearly from a discursive discourse analysis.
Ed does it too. Now that you think about it,
right.
Ed does it a lot.
Yeah. And there's power implications, right? As soon as if it's not me saying it, then it carries more weight. Right? By distancing myself from it, it sounds more objective. All that's there. So I'm sorry, Viv. I'm not trying to sidestep what you said. I'm just trying to bring in that it's a very complex area that oscillates again.
Yeah. And my interest in it was very specific in regard to professional identity and how the I is what is projected within the profession, but the personal perspective, what you may truly believe or that perspective, is only found in the me, which never comes out of that profession, in that professional sphere.
Okay.
Okay.
So, and that's how I was looking at her, how I was being explained to me. I just thought it was kind of along the same lines right now, but...
I'd have to think about that more, but if, but we'll come back to that idea again. So, Fiona, thank you.